I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the complicated story of adoption in Haiti. But first, this country's top military leader said today that gays should serve openly in the military. It's the right thing to do. And Admiral Mike Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, added, the military can handle it.
No matter how I look at this issue, I cannot escape being troubled by the fact that we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens.
He's referring to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the policy that has barred gay Americans from openly serving in the armed forces since 1993. It's under review at a Senate hearing today, with the military announcing new rules coming and a panel that will ultimately study how the military would lift entirely the ban on openly gay service members. Michael Scheer is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. He's been following all of this. Michael, Admiral Mullen has written about his feelings, but how significant was this moment when he actually vocalized them today?
You know, I think it's really significant. For the advocates of this change, the people who want to see the ban on gay members of the military lifted, to see the top military official actually state in very strong language, surprisingly strong language, that he thinks the policy is wrong and ought to be lifted, I think is going to be seen as a quite a significant boost to their point of view.
Well, Defense Secretary Robert Gates also spoke. What exactly is being proposed?
Well, there's two things that are being proposed. You know, it was interesting. The Secretary of Defense basically came out at the opening of his statement and said, look, the president wants to change this. The president wants this policy removed, and we're gonna you know, march and follow that order. He then went on, though, to say that basically it would take a fair amount of time for the military to evaluate how best to do this and all of the implications that might follow and things that the military needs to be aware of. So they're going to establish a special commission, a special panel to do some of that stuff, and they're also going to look into making some changes in how they enforce the policy in the meantime.
And what would those be?
Well, right now, folks who are gay and who keep that to themselves can serve in the military, but they're often outed by other people. They are often their homosexuality is often made known by a third party, somebody else who maybe doesn't like them. And once that is made known, the military is essentially bound to discharge them to proceed to disciplinary action. What Secretary Gates suggested was that they're going to do a final review, but that they think that they can, what he said, enforce it more humanely and more fairly, which probably means stopping these third-party disciplinary procedures.
Who spoke in opposition today?
Well, Senator McCain was a real significant voice. He's, of course, the ranking member on the committee and ran for president, as we all remember. He spoke very forcefully against this, saying that the country is at war in two places and that for issues of cohesion and not disrupting the force, that this should not be something that is pursued at this time. He specifically scolded Secretary Gates, saying he was disappointed that Secretary Gates seems to be prejudging the issue before the Congress has an opportunity to look into it.
Well, and I was going to ask, what happens next? Yes, there's going to be a panel, but does Congress have to sign off on what that panel finds?
Yeah, both the Secretary and Admiral Mullins were very clear that while they believe that this is the direction the military should go, that they recognize that Congress has the final word on whether or not to reverse the policy. The Democrats on the panel, who are, of course, in charge, made it clear that they intend to move forward with an examination of this, that there will be more hearings, there will be legislative action pursued. The Republicans, obviously, on the panel think that that's not a good idea, so there will be a legislative clash at the same time that this new panel at the Pentagon is looking into sort of the mechanics of it all.
And in the meantime, just a couple footnotes to put it in context. Polls show that a majority of Americans support openly gay service. A majority did not in 1993. And since 93, over 10,000 troops have been dismissed under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy from the Clinton administration. Michael Scheer, White House correspondent for The Washington Post, following this all for us. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Well, we have an update now on those 10 American missionaries imprisoned in Haiti for trying to bus 33 children from Haiti across the border to the Dominican Republic without paperwork. The Haitian government has concerns about child trafficking and says although they were in an orphanage, not all the children are orphans. But the Today Show spoke with Haitians who said the missionaries and their group, New Life Children's Refuge, based in Idaho, Kansas, and Texas, were just bringing kids from an orphanage to a safe place. And Jean Seville, a Haitian in the U.S. who worked with the orphanage, said if children in the group had parents, those parents were contacted.
I had verbal agreement from the parents with their names and their contact phone number. And also they have our contact numbers. If they want to go to the Dominican Republic to see the children, or if they want to come get the children.
Well, let's take a look today at issues of adoption in the wake of the Haitian earthquake. And we want to start with Tom DeFilippo. He's president of the Joint Council on International Children's Services, a Washington-based child welfare organization that tracks international adoptions. And Tom, the missionaries say they got parental permission, and a lot of parents in Haiti, we know, bring children to orphanages to take care of the kids, but don't necessarily want them adopted. So this makes for a very complicated picture.
Yes, it does. Yes, absolutely. And first, having permission just from the orphanage to cross the border obviously is not sufficient. A lot of groups have good intentions and are inspired to do work, but they need sufficient information before they make a move like this. I think it's pretty obvious that any child needs documentation before they leave a country. But it does get very complicated. Some children go into the orphanage because of economic reasons, and that's obviously a tragedy that continues to occur not just in Haiti but around the world. The problem is distinguishing between the children who go into the orphanage and have their parents continue to visit, and those that remain in the orphanage for economic reasons, and their parents never come back to visit. We were at a number of orphanages this past week in Haiti. They were the stories that we heard. A few children saw their parents every month, every 2 months. Others had not seen their parents for 2 to 3 years.
So how do groups like yours deal with this? We know you've started a database. But it seems like it's not something, it's a very subjective thing. It's not the kind of thing that can easily fit into a available, not available.
Right. Unfortunately, it's not always black and white. And one of the issues that we're very, very concerned about at this point is the family reunification programs that need to be put into place immediately so that they don't take 2 to 3 to 4 years, because it is a subjective assessment of the child and whether or not they need it. An adoption or a placement, a different type of placement to have a permanent family. And that adoption could be domestic or international. It could be permanent guardianship within the country, kinship care. But what we've seen in too many places, too many refugee camps, after the tsunami, we've seen family reunification programs taking, and I'm not exaggerating, 3, 4, 7, 10 years. And meanwhile, this child is living in a deprived situation. We had, again, visited an orphanage built for 40 children, had 92 children in it. They had such a depraved situation that they didn't even have enough plates. The kids would eat off the concrete floor, their little piles of rice. Having a child live in that situation for years while we're looking for extended family members certainly is not in their best interest.
Well, you said not all children in orphanages are truly orphans, but it seems the situation is further complicated because not all orphanages are in the business of adoption. I'm thinking of the U.S.-based group HOPE, or Haiti Orphanage That Protects and Educates. A Christian couple from Ohio runs the HOPE Center for Orphan Girls in Haiti. We were aware of them before the earthquake. They say their mission is to provide for these orphan girls into adulthood. They're very clear. The girls are not candidates for adoption. Now, they now want to bring some of them to the U.S. to keep them safe, but their ultimate goal is to help them be educated citizens in Haiti. They will return there. Given the questions about parentage, is that a model that should be considered more and more if they're not eating off the concrete floor, if they're being cared for?
There's a lot of different models and a lot of different organizations employ different strategies. However, it's our position that the ultimate goal should be a permanent, safe family for each child. That's a basic human right. So it's a good interim step. It helps give safety to children while they're growing up, but the goal should always be a permanent family for each kid.
But as you say, that's just gotten so complicated in Haiti because you don't know who's really available for a new family. They may have family in Haiti. Given all of this, we now have these huge questions because of the earthquake, but What about the adoptions that were already underway? We've seen wonderfully heartwarming stories of news anchors finding children in Haiti and getting them to their adoptive parents here in the U.S. But how is that going overall, outside of those heartwarming stories?
Well, we still have about, just coming into the U.S., approximately another 400 children that had initiated the adoption process. It's not been all the warm fuzzies that you see on the nightly newscast. There's been a lot of struggle. We've had children, you know, again, living in these depraved situations, even more so since the earthquake. And now we're into now week three. By the time the rest of those children are united with their families, it'll be 4, 5, 6 weeks. So it's going, but it's not going fast enough.
It's probably going to slow down now, given that there's concern that some children may be leaving Haiti who aren't orphans. Is that going to foul up these adoptions that have already been in the pipeline for sometimes 2-3 years?
Well, as soon as we saw the newscast that these Americans had been arrested or detained for taking children out of the country, that was a concern. However, all of the children that we're working with in terms of having their adoption started before the earthquake, it's documented the U.S. government is reviewing each and every individual case, and then they're receiving travel approval from the Haitian government. So in terms of this one population of children, we think there's plenty of safeguards to make sure that we're not bringing children out of the country that shouldn't be. However, there's two pieces I think that are, one's obvious and one's not so obvious. There's a lot of attention on the adoption issue. Adoption, number one, should not be, new adoption should not be initiated at this time. And the main issues for us, or main concerns, are the cross borders into the Dominican Republic, because children are sometimes used for indentured servitude in the Dominican Republic, especially when it's a Haitian child, you know, different culture, different race. And then within Haiti, there's the Restivik population of children who are sold by their parents or given away by their parents to be child slaves.
Explain that word, Restivik.
It's a Creole term that means to take care of or to house or to be with. What it actually is in practice is a family who's economically struggling and can't afford to take care of their children may give their child away or sell their child to another individual who will then use that child as a slave in their house or a slave for industry producing products. And we use the word slave simply because they own this child. They sell them from one group to the next. These children are abused. And in this situation, we don't know where all the kids are. We don't know where their parents are. We don't know where their extended families are. They can be easily snatched into the Restivik community and become a Restivik. The Haitian NGOs, those two issues I just mentioned, the cross-border and the Restivik, that's their main concern. The press is having a field day with the adoption issue, but the stories that are being missed are the indentured servitude of children moving cross-border and the Restivik child slaves.
Tom DiFilippo, president of the Joint Council on International Children's Services. That's a Washington-based child welfare organization. Thanks so much for giving us some of your time.
Thank you, Robin.
We've been talking about Haitian adoptions following the arrest of 10 American missionaries who faced trial for attempting to take 33 children, some with parents, out of Haiti. They say they had permission from the kids' parents, and Agence France-Presse is now reporting that those families and their kids are being reunited. But joining us on the line now from Haiti is Deb Barry from the group Save the Children. They work to feed families in Haiti. They're also trying to reunite kids with relatives. And Deb, what does the story of the missionaries tell you?
We are concerned that there is a lot of confusion. Save the Children, the United Nations, the government, we're working together to actually set up a tracing program so that we're actually able to find out which children still have living relatives and who are able to return to their relative. 380,000 children were in orphanages before the earthquake, and many of those, like you said, were there for economic reasons. And, you know, this is a concern to us. But what we're also saying is, you know, we also need an opportunity to help these children now and these families. It's not fair to, you know, take these children out of the country, you know, leaving behind these families who don't know what's happened to their children. We also still have families who are looking for their children, trying to get information about them from the orphanages that have closed down, or for even those children who were involved in the domestic servitude, which also is another big problem here in Haiti.
Well, meantime, in reaction to fears that children are being trafficked out of Haiti, the Haitian government has now changed its rules. A personal authorization from the prime minister is now required for the departure of any child. Do you think that's a good move?
I think what it's done right now is actually has put us into a situation where we really have needed to have official documentation that is checked. There are so many people claiming that documentation has been lost. There is a concern that people will abuse the situation. Trafficking has been an issue before here in the country, and what they're trying to do now is to make sure that those people who are in the process of adopting or those people who are legitimate can actually still go through the process. And there's getting the fine balance right now between actually where are the legal paperwork. Have the parents really been told the situation and what is going on? As you can imagine, in an emergency situation like this, we hear rumors every day of different things that are happening, and the government and the United Nations is trying to understand what are the legal paperwork right here, right now, and we hope that people will understand that by doing this, this actually allows us to protect more children. It may be frustrating for people who are watching to think, why can't they just let these children out? But unfortunately, we do live in a world where there are people who are there to exploit some of these children.
Well, and we're reminded, too, that this is not an unusual problem in conflict. We're thinking of Zoe's Ark, the French group that was charged by Chad with stealing children from that country. They were initially charged and then sent back to France. Does this happen more than we know, this kind of question as to what the motives are?
We know that we, as organizations who work for children and families in emergency situations, that we have to make decisions about, you know, working and strengthening the government. We have to work at protecting the children and what's in their best interest. And by setting certain standards in place, we hopefully stop individuals or small groups of people coming in and actually making, you know, very quick decisions without maybe realizing the full implications.
Yeah. Well, another thing you have to contend with is the Associated Press reported that of 20 Haitian parents that reporters spoke with, only one said she wouldn't give up her children to give them a chance at a better life. It feels, too, that on that end of the equation, how do you explain to Haitian parents who desperately want their children to have a chance, a shot at something, that this may not be the best choice right now? I mean, you know, it's not just the American aid organizations that are coming in.
Right.
It's the parents who are holding out their children.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's a very difficult situation. As we go to community groups now, parents are desperate. You can imagine, you know, we're 20 days after the earthquake has struck, and people are still looking for food and water and the basic shelter and are getting ready for things like the rainy season coming up. And so when you talk to parents, of course, they're very desperate, and we're trying to explain to them that there are going to be the aid coming out. We were out yesterday, say the children, delivering aid. We delivered 2-week food rations to 1,700 families. And as we, you know, those families came through, and I met actually with one woman who was 8.5 months pregnant, has 3 under children. And yes, she was very desperate. She had been lining up since 5:30 in the morning. We were there at 7 distributing food. And she said she would have waited all night, just that desperation and worried about what her children were actually going to have and was more food coming. And those, you know, are real heartbreaking decisions to these parents. And as I've met with parents over the last week, you know, they want that promise that help is on the way. And, of course, they love their children so much. They want to be able to keep their children. But sometimes it's very hard when they haven't had food, they haven't had a good night's sleep. They're very vulnerable to making decisions about their children. And so what we're trying to do is help them have the basics right now so that they can make wise decisions and think longer term.
And one last question. Deb Barry, again, a Global Child Protector Advisor for Save the Children. We understand you're setting up child-friendly spaces in Haiti. What does that look like? What does that feel like?
Oh, child-friendly spaces is a great program that we do around the world. And what it does is it actually brings children together in a place within the camp so that parents can still see them. They can know that they're involved in activities, dancing, singing. We talk to them about what to do if another aftershock happens. I managed to speak with a group of 50 children on Friday who were telling me in the child-friendly spaces on how excited they are to be able to go back to school, and they're really hoping that the schools will be set up soon so they can go back and continue learning, and they really want to rebuild Haiti. They said, you know, they wanted to be engineers and they wanted to be starting to look at better ways so that the buildings don't come down.
Hmm.
They've been through a lot, but we really hope that they'll be able to move forward from this and build a stronger Haiti.
Deb Barry of Save the Children speaking to us from Haiti, and we'll have ways you can find out more about her group and others we mentioned, including the Hope Center for Orphaned Girls. Deb, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for covering the story.
Dead fish continue to wash up on Florida beaches after last month's record cold spell. The far north is having the opposite problem. In what's called the boreal region, a layer of spongy peat 15 feet deep in places extending more than 6 million square miles across Russia, Scandinavia, China, Canada, and the U.S., there, the frozen ground is slowly thawing, creating what scientists are calling a carbon bomb. Last December in Copenhagen, countries agreed on a plan to reduce carbon emissions from deforestation, but the main focus was on tropical forests being cut down, not on peat bogs thawing. Enter Jeff Wells. He's pushing for more conservation of these northern forests and peatlands, as he calls them. He's senior scientist for the advocacy group, the International Boreal Conservation Campaign. Jeff, tell us first, what is peat?
Well, peat is composed of mosses that grow on the surface and then layers of dead plant material underneath, and they're generally saturated with water. The boreal region has the largest peatland complexes in the world, areas that just stretch for miles and miles. And they tend to be, many of them, very open, parkland-like areas, and there's not a lot of large trees that grow on them because, again, they are saturated with water, so there you have sort of smaller clumps of trees.
But the peat, I guess, does the same thing that trees do, which is absorb carbon?
Absolutely. The mosses and the herbaceous plants that are in these peatlands absorb carbon. But because these areas are in cold regions, the plant material doesn't decompose, and it tends to go deeper and deeper down into the layers, and it can be organic material that's thousands of years old underneath that surface layer.
What is your concern about the peat releasing carbon? How does that happen, and what do you want to see stopped?
You have issues like forestry, like mining, oil and gas, power lines, all of which can disturb the layer of peat and soil underneath and increase the carbon emissions.
But why don't we know as much about it as we do about, for instance, Brazil's rainforest?
Well, I think people have focused on the tropical regions because of their high diversity. What people haven't recognized as much is that there are a whole suite of conservation values in these northern boreal regions that are also equally important, including things like grizzly bears and wolves that we've seen lost from much of the rest of North America.
You also say the plants and peat in this area hold an amount of carbon equal to what 26 years of burning fossils at the current rate would emit. So now there is an international agreement about forest degradation. So what's lacking for you?
Well, I think the next step for us is to see a recognition of the northern boreal forests in this as well. Most of the mechanisms that have been put forth so far relate to tropical forests, and we completely agree that those should receive a high priority. But we can't ignore this massive carbon store in the north, and we also don't want to ignore the local communities and the indigenous peoples of these northern regions that are in need of economic support, and they need an incentive to make sure that they maintain the carbon in those forests just like people in tropical developing countries do.
Well, meanwhile, Jeff Wells, you know, many of us know what it's like to hike through a wet forest and underneath our feet these grasses and peat moss. But what's it like in these forests when it's 15 feet deep?
Well, in places where it's 15 feet deep, you probably don't want to try to walk through it. But, you know, a lot of peatlands, when you go out on them, they actually can quake a little bit and flex up and down. There's some kinds of peatlands that actually still have water underneath them, and they're sort of floating. So a lot of times as you walk in them, you can sink deep into them. It's kind of neat. There's some species of birds that are pretty unique just to peatlands. There's a bird called the palm warbler that was first discovered in wintering in palm trees of Florida in the southeast. But then they go up to the peatlands of Canada to nest, and they really specialize just in these carbon-rich peatlands,
which Jeff and others now want to preserve. Jeff is senior scientist for the International Boreal Conservation Campaign. Thanks so much for talking to us about it, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you.
And here's that palm warbler that Jeff mentioned from Spring Pond Bog in New York, thanks to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Back in just 30 seconds or so with the Oscar nods. Let's go to the movies here and now. Recently, we brought you the story of how Israel's economic blockade has led to an underground economy in the Palestinian territory, Gaza, with products smuggled in through tunnels connected to Egypt. Well, a hot commodity? Motorbikes. Thousands of them have been smuggled in via the tunnels. The problem is most people in Gaza don't really know how to ride the bikes. In the past year, at least 200 people have died in accidents. The BBC's John Donison reports from Gaza City.
This is, without doubt, I would have thought, the quickest way to get around the traffic-infested streets of Gaza City. And it certainly raises the pulse a little bit, I can tell you. I'm on the back of a very shiny-looking bike, the Halawa Tiger, reasonably ably steered by my driver, Mohammed, who's trying desperately to avoid the potholes and the occasional donkey and cart. There are now thousands of bikes across Gaza, but it is not the safest way to get around.
Limping into the small money-changing office where he works, 28-year-old Mohammed Abu Kamar shows me his injuries. An ugly, unnatural lump on the back of his head where he severely fractured his skull. He also had a broken leg. He tells me that last year he spent a week in intensive care after his motorbike was hit by a car. Mohammed was dragged along behind it. He says it's a miracle he's still alive. Well, I've come now to the intensive care unit, the ICU, at Shifa Hospital. That's the main hospital in Gaza City. It's where Mohammed was treated for his injuries just a few months ago. You can probably hear all the monitors from the various bits of electrical equipment around me. Now, Dr. Fauzi Nabusia, he is head of the ICU unit here, and he says in recent years there's been a dramatic rise in the number of people being treated for serious injuries from motorcycle accidents.
The motorcycle accident is the most cause for ICU admission during the last 2 years. Roughly, we managed 2 to 3 cases weekly.
That's just in the intensive care unit. What about the rest of the hospital?
30 to 40 patients every week admitted in surgical or orthopedic department.
How many of those people riding a bike wear a helmet?
2%.
2% of people wearing a helmet?
Yes, yeah. Maximum 2%. And death, about 30 to 40% dying.
30 to 40% of the people you treat here for motorbike accidents will die?
Yeah, which managed in ICU, in a critical situation.
Well, such figures certainly don't seem to have deterred anyone here. I'm at the main motorcycle market here in Gaza City, and there are literally hundreds of bikes lined up in front of me, many of them for sale. Let's just see how much they're going for. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Gadish, how much?
$800.
Can you do for any less?
Mumkin.
Possibly. Possibly. It's a nice bike. Where do these bikes come from?
From Egypt.
From Egypt?
Yes.
Through the tunnels?
Yes.
Now, I'm just having a little look on your bike here, and there's a little label on the top which says, warning, wear a safety cap, glasses and shining colour cloth. Do not drive after drinking alcoholics, and read the user manual carefully before riding. Have you done all that, sir? He tells me you can't drink alcohol in Gaza, so that isn't a problem. What about all the other things? He says normally most people follow the rules and they drive pretty slowly. Well, just standing in the center of Gaza City, bikes zipping all around me, you might dispute that. Hamas, who control Gaza, say they are cracking down on people riding without a license or a helmet. But given that it's pretty common to see two or even three Hamas men squeezed bareheaded onto motorbikes, you wonder how strictly that will be enforced. As for Mohammed, limping around his money-changing shop, there's one question.
Would you get on a motorbike again?
No. No.
That report from the BBC's John Donison in Gaza City.
I'm pleased to announce that the 10 films selected as Best Picture nominees for 2009 are Avatar.
The 82nd Annual Academy Award nominations were announced today in Los Angeles, and the Best Picture category went on.
District 9.
And on.
And Education.
And on.
The Hurt Locker. Inglourious Basterds.
10 nominations in all, something that hasn't happened since 1943. James Cameron's 3D fantasy Avatar and Catherine Bigelow's Bomb Squad in Iraq drama The Hurt Locker led the field with 9 nominations each. But there were also surprises like the sci-fi drama District 9 and Disney Pixar's Up. Joining us on the line to talk about the Oscar race, Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr, who's celebrating his favorite day. Right, Ty?
Close to.
And we know they lengthened this list of best films to diversify the field. Did you feel they did?
I think they fielded a field of 10 nominees that really has a good balance. Big popcorn movies like Avatar. You've got populist popcorn movies like Blindside. You've got art house popcorn movies like, you know, District 9 and Inglourious Basterds. You got art house movies like, you know, An Education. And then you've got, you know, these kind of little movies that probably in previous years would have gotten a screenplay nomination like Precious and The Hurt Locker. And then you've got Pixar. And the whole reason that they decided to expand the Best Picture slate to 10 was because there was a sense that big animations and movies like The Dark Knight were getting left out.
All right. Well, let's take a quick look at the front runners. James Cameron's Avatar steamrolled at the box office, picked up major awards. It takes place on the faraway world of Pandora, where the humans are in conflict with an alien race. In this scene, actor Zoe Saldana, who plays the alien Neytiri, introduces Jake, a human, played by Sam Worthington, to one of the mysterious creatures of Pandora.
Zizi. Damn, damn, Zizi. A gran is not a horse.
Ty, we just heard a whole new language, a fantasy world. Enough to get Cameron Best Picture?
The movie is now officially a major pop culture event. I mean, it's entered Titanic land, you know, long ago. In this particular slate, it's impossible to say who will win because there are twice as many variables.
Yeah. We're talking Oscars with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr about this year's Oscar nominations, which just came out today. Perhaps you received one. There were so many nods in the best film category. We'll have them all at our website, hereandnow.org. But Ty, we mentioned Avatar, James Cameron. His closest competition for both Best Picture and Director is predicted to be his ex-wife, Catherine Bigelow. Her film, The Hurt Locker, focuses on a team that deactivates IEDs, improvised explosive devices, in Iraq. Here's a scene.
Uh-huh. There we go. This one. This one. From the UN building. Flaming car. Dead man switch. Boom. This guy was good. I like him. This one. This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
What about this one? Ty, war movies haven't done very well recently. Your thoughts on this one?
One, the movie is well worth seeing, and I'm glad it's got 9 Oscar nominations because that means more people will see it. But it's also a validation of Bigelow, not just as a woman filmmaker and the kind of woman filmmaker she is. She makes action movies, but a good filmmaker, a great filmmaker. You know, one that, for my money, I think she's a better filmmaker, as good a filmmaker as her ex-husband, if not better. And, you know, the nice thing is that they're on extremely friendly terms, so this is kind of a win-win for both of them.
Yeah. Okay, so that's Ty Burr on Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker, again, a nomination for Best Film and Director. Let's take a look, Ty, at a Best Picture nominee we know you're happy about. It's the Coen brothers, A Serious Man. It's about a man whose life is unraveling.
I'm a serious... I've Tried to be a serious man, you know? Tried to do right, be a member of the community, raise the... Danny, Sarah, they both go to school, Hebrew school, a good breakfast.
You named this one of the best films of the decade.
Oh, yes. Well, I also named it, you know, best film of the year. I mean, it's a movie I really, really like. I was being provocative when I named it best of the decade. We'll see. Time will tell. The Coen brothers generally have their movies recognized in the screenplay categories, but they never quite sneak into best picture. And I'm delighted to see it in the, you know, expanded best picture field. I think it belongs there. I think it's a, you know, it's a tough movie. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but I think it's, they knock it out of the park.
Well, the Coen brothers are filmmakers, as is Quentin Tarantino. His World War II set, Inglourious Basterds, picked up 8 nominations. Let's listen to a scene with Brad Pitt.
We're going to be dropped into France, dressed as civilians. Once we're in enemy territory, as a bushwhacking guerrilla army, we're going to be doing one thing, and one thing only. Killing Nazis.
So, Ty, are Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie really breaking up? No, I don't mean to ask you that.
I have no idea. I don't care.
Were you surprised by 8 nominations for Brad Pitt's film there?
Well, you know, this is, again, as No Country for Old Men was for the Coen brothers a couple of years ago, this is validation for Quentin Tarantino. You know, the bad boy of 90s, you know, indie movies is now, he's mainstream. And this is a movie that really tapped into a mainstream audience, to my surprise and a lot of other people's surprise. You know, a lot of people love this movie. It's fun. It's a great ride, but it's also, you know, measurably Tarantino. His time has sort of been coming, and this is the one that's, you know, going to bring him in.
Let's move on to the race for Best Actress, Meryl Streep. This isn't really surprising, but she received her 16th Oscar nomination. I think that's a record of some kind, for her channeling of a Julia Child.
When you flip anything, you've just got to have the courage of your convictions, especially if it's a loose sort of mass, like, oh, that didn't go very well.
Ty, it's sort of recently gotten to the point where what would an award ceremony be without Meryl Streep?
That's true. But she's also been, not only has she been working a lot lately, she's been working in a lot of different kinds of films. It's no longer the, you know, the serious dramas of her earlier days. Now she's doing comedy, she's doing musicals, she's doing whatever she wants. And more to the point, she's having fun. Julie and Julia was a fun movie, and her performance was just incredible entertainment.
Well, she receives her 16th nomination. Sandra Bullock gets her first. She played the wealthy Memphis mom, Leanne Tui, in The Blind Side, the story of how Leanne and her family took in and eventually adopted a homeless teenager who goes on to become a star football player. Here's a scene where Sandra Bullock, as Leanne, snaps at friends who question her.
Look, here's the deal. I don't need y'all to approve my choices, all right? But I do ask that you respect them. You have no idea what this boy's been through, and if this is going to become some running diatribe, I can find an overpriced salad a lot closer to home.
Ty, what's interesting is that Sandra Bullock is also up for a Razzie, you know, a Raspberry, for Worst Actress of the Year for All About Steve.
All About Steve, which, you know, she could win that, and she could possibly win, you know, an Oscar and a Razzie in the same year. I mean, it's been a good year for her, and she also had, you know, an extremely popular film in The Proposal. I mean, she really had, you know, she now has a full-on second act as a movie star.
Well, other nominees for Best Actress include Helen Mirren for The Last Station, Carey Mulligan for An Education, and newcomer Gabory Sidibe, who stars as Precious, the teen abused by her mother and impregnated by her stepfather. She goes to an alternative school in Harlem. In this scene, the teacher asks her to tell a little bit about herself.
I live in Harlem. I like yellow. And I have problems at my other school, so I come here.
Something you do well?
Nothing.
Ty, almost documentary feel, tour de force, but she's up against Meryl Streep. I mean, just your thoughts.
Every year in the supporting category or the actress category, the Academy likes to pull a deserving newcomer out of the woodwork and say, you know, here's your moment. And often they don't win the award, and the sense is that, you know, you should be thankful you just got nominated. On the other hand, Gabory Sidibe gives a terrific performance. I hope that she has a career beyond this movie. I hope that audiences in the industry can think outside the box and give her a career beyond this movie, because she's a really terrific performer.
Finally, Best Actor, nominees including George Clooney for Up in the Air, Colin Firth for A Single Man. But, you know, people feel this could be the year for Jeff Bridges in Crazy Heart as a down-and-out country singer. Here he is in a scene with Maggie Gyllenhaal, also nominated for Best Supporting Actress. She plays an aspiring reporter.
What's your real name?
I'm Bad Blake. Wasn't born bad. When I die, my tombstone will have my real name on it. Until then, I'm just going to stay bad.
Ty, great performance, but is this also in part, you know, a Hollywood popularity contest?
Oh, absolutely. The Oscars are a popularity contest, or, you know, rather they're a sample of what the voters are thinking at the moment they fill their ballots out. With the acting categories, you often do get a sort of a summary judgment on a performer who's been around for a long while. In this case, Bridges, who's very well loved by audiences, by the industry, he's never won an Oscar. This is Jeff Bridges' time.
So Ty Burr of the Boston Globe, just some closing thoughts. It's an exhausting enterprise this year, just because there's so many nominees for Best Film. But you know, it's just some closing thoughts on today's nominations.
I liked the fact that the Academy didn't just award nominations to 10 movies in the Best Picture category, but they spread the nominations out in the other categories as well. I mean, you've got 9 Sherlock Holmes, Young Victoria, Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, the Harry Potter movie, Star Trek, all getting nominations in different categories. And I think that's actually sort of a vote of confidence for the industry as a whole. I think it reflects well on what Hollywood is able to do. In a year where they actually give a original score nomination to Wes Anderson's stop-motion animation Fantastic Mr. Fox, that's a good year.
Let's listen as we go out. That's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. The Academy Awards will be given out on March 7th, but the fun begins today talking about the nominees. Ty, thanks so much.
Sure. Thanks, Rob.